Live from the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Albaugh Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Albaugh.
Across Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to hour number two of the Todd Albaugh Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. As we said, producer and engineer, Mr. Aaron Zommers on the board. We love it when he's here. Thanks for being here, Mr. Zommers.
It's always a good time.
It's always a good time had by all. As my 8th grade social studies professor, teacher, Ken Lewis is fond of saying, great time is had by all. Good time is had by all. It is Monday, as we said, July 10th, 2023. Coming up at the bottom of this hour, great guest in this hour, Brian Van Hooker. He is a staff writer for Mel Magazine, specializing in pop culture, food, especially pizza, and long-form oral histories. Also a feature writer for Cracked Magazine. Great guy. Also the co-creator of comic book Barnum and Elwood and The Tramp. And he wrote a comedy pilot starring John O'Hurley. Has a podcast called Turtle Tracks. And this may be the biggest one. Was once called a good guy by Mr. T. I want to find out, did he say that in person or did he just come upon it? How does that Mr. T calls you a good guy?
Well, you'll have a good opportunity to ask him today.
That's right. Coming up at the bottom of the hour. So looking forward to that. You've seen Seinfeld, have you not, Mr. Zommers?
Yeah, not like the whole show. Right. But.
So it was big, but when I was, you know, in college back in the 90s. And he wrote an oral history on the deceptively small oral history of quote-unquote shrinkage, the perfect Seinfeldian word. Before Seinfeld, there was no English word to describe what happens when your junk happens to your junk in cold air and water. But after it first appeared in the 1994 episode, the world couldn't get enough of what they called the frightened turtle. So it was a great episode in which George ends up, you know, stepping in some cold water and air, and other people see him naked. He's like, it was shrinkage. And apparently, Brian Van Hooker has written an oral history on this. Or gave it oral history. So we'll be talking to him at the bottom of the hour. Looking forward to that. The start of this hour, a much more serious topic on what's happening in America's military right now in terms of certain things being held up by, I find an extraordinarily unqualified United States Senator in Tommy Tuberville. All right. Tommy Tuberville was a longtime college coach and a fairly successful one down in Auburn, down in Alabama. And then kind of Trumpism, and he was a big Trumpster, and he decides to run for United States Senate. And when you're a big time college football coach and you live in Alabama and you're a Trump supporter, of course you're going to get elected. And so there's an article in Wisconsin, actually it's on PBS.org, the PBS NewsHour. For the first time in over a century, the United States Marine Corps will not have a permanent leader. Current Marine Corps Commandant David Berger is required to retire today. But due to a hold on hundreds of military promotions by Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, there is no confirmed replacement. If this continues, other branches will face the same problem soon. And this is a fascinating story to me. Because being a former Republican myself, I left the party in 2011. Republicans love literally and figuratively to clothe themselves in the American flag. And we said this back on July 4th and said it on Flag Day. I don't believe the United States flag should be co-opted by any one party. It is a symbol of all Americans. Emphasize all Americans. I myself have a great deal of respect for the men and women who serve in active duty, who are in the reserves, who are America's veterans. And throughout most of our history, our major two parties, Republicans and Democrats, have been able to agree on the basic functionality of America's military. Understanding that our national defense comes first. It should not be polarized by partisan politics. And yet here we have Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, Trumpster supporter, holding up the confirmation of the commandant, the top official in the United States Marine Corps. Here's the reporting by Anna Norris. For the first time in over a century, the U.S. Marine Corps will not have a permanent leader. The current commandant, David Berger, was in his last week of the job. He was required to retire today. But due to a hold on hundreds of military promotions by Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, there is no confirmed replacement. And if this continues, other branches will soon have the same problem. To help unpack the standoff, she was joined by congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins. And so they asked, Anna Norris asks in this interview, what is the senator doing here and why? And when we come back, we're going to explain this, why Tommy Tuberville is holding up all these confirmations of the U.S. military. Why would he put America's security, our military, ahead of his personal political policies? We'll explain it, take your phone calls as well, and our interview at the bottom of the hour with Brian Van Hooker from Cracked and Mel Magazine. Don't want to miss it. Don't go anywhere. This is the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. The Todd Allball Show across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. It is now 2:15 on the time and temperature sign. Glad to have you along with us. Mr. Aaron Zommers on the board, myself on the mic, and you at home on the radio, on the app, and on the phone. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call, 844-967-2789. Again, 844-967-2789. Talking this segment about the United States military, our readiness as a country. And in this interview over the weekend on PBS, breaking it down, why Tommy Tuberville, the conservative Republican Trumpism senator from Alabama, former college football coach, why is he standing up to, why is he preventing our military readiness? Lisa Desjardins, reporter at PBS, put it this way. She said, Tuberville is flexing the power, unique power, of an individual senator to affect the time on the floor, and he is blocking 250 now, military promotions. The 250 are senior-level officers, flag officers, think generals and admirals by and large. Now, the issue is, she says, of course, why is he doing this? Why is he slowing down these nominations? It's about abortion. Senator Tuberville objects to the now defense policy put in place after the end of Roe v. Wade, in which it says the Defense Department of the U.S. will pay for travel for a service member to get an elective abortion if there's not one available where they are based. And then they play a cut from Tuberville. Here's what Tuberville said. I'll read it verbatim. Quote, these holds have no real impact on military readiness or operations. The military wasting time and resources to coordinate abortion trips hurts readiness, not the Senate using regular order to vote on nominees. Unquote.
First of all, no. How does, if you have someone in the military who's like, I need to continue to serve, now is not the time for me to start a family. What do you mean that doesn't affect readiness if they can't do that?
Great point, Mr. Zommers. Let me just finish this. The reporter goes on to say, now, sources close to Tuberville tell me he's also unhappy because Defense Secretary Austin only called him once. Well, I wonder why. You understand, this guy is a narcissist. You want to meet people, but not all, but a lot of people who are self-important. Try a college football coach at a major place like Auburn University. And then a United States senator? Most of those folks are not humble people. Most. So Tuberville apparently is also ticked off because the defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, has only called him once. Reporter says Tuberville feels like he warned that he might do this. He wants more engagement. But those around the defense secretary, the military says, he's not going to negotiate, nor should any defense secretary with a single senator over their policy. So quickly, let's look at what's ahead in the next couple of weeks. So as you just reported, the commandant of the Marine Corps retires today. It says Monday, but now it's today. But that's not the only thing coming. In August, near the beginning of August, the Army Chief of Staff will retire first. Then shortly thereafter, the Chief of Naval Operations, also due to retire. Then followed in October, the very top military officer of our nation, the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, set to retire with confirmed replacements. All of those will be filled by acting officers. So this is a combination. Tommy Tuberville, Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, using this excuse of, well, I don't like the fact that the policy of the Defense Department says that they'll pay for a service member to travel to some place to get a voluntary abortion. And then secondarily, according to sources, Tuberville also ticked off that he's not getting enough attention, enough love, enough credit from the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. I have a little insight on this, all right? I know a little something about this. I used to handle military affairs for former Congressman Scott Klug of Madison back in the 90s. Here's the deal. Scott Klug was a pro-choice Republican. There were a couple of caveats. One of them was he didn't support military paying for abortions. That didn't get a lot of play. But you want to know what? It was hardly ever an issue, quite frankly. The number of times that would come up that was necessary was very rare. So number one, this has been a big deal on something that doesn't happen that often. And to Mr. Zomer's point, when it does, in certain states, it may not necessarily be voluntary, such as Wisconsin. And I know, Aaron, that Dr. Kristen Lyerly, an OBGYN, comes on both Pat Kreitler's program, Up North News in the Morning, and also does a weekly segment with Kristen Bryan, As Goes Wisconsin. And she's talked about this, that in Wisconsin right now, under current Wisconsin law, after Roe v. Wade was turned over, the only legal thing or reason abortion can be done in Wisconsin is for the life of the mother, to save the life of the mother.
And as she has said many times, that's not written out clearly. So
exactly.
Basically you have to wait until, do I think she's dying enough now that I can help her?
Exactly.
No, if she would not die if I don't help right now, then I can't help yet or else I won't be able to practice anymore.
And depending upon the OBGYN, certain OBGYNs may be willing to make that decision quicker than others, depending upon how much they want to risk their entire career and their license.
It makes sense because, yes, you're saving the life of this one person, but your job is saving the lives of a lot of people, and one wants to be in that position.
No, and so the point is that, to Aaron and Dr. Lyerly's point tangentially, that when a woman may be in a position where she has to have an abortion to save her life, it may be too late to safely transport her to another state where she can get that done. So what you're really talking about is women who are serving in the military, who may have intentionally gotten pregnant with their partner, and then find themselves in a situation where they have to abort the pregnancy to save the life of the mother. And Tommy Tuberville does not want to pay for that person that wears the uniform to save their life. That's what it amounts to. And in order to drive that point home, something that happens rarely anyway, but when, I mean, if it were your kid, your wife, your spouse, your daughter, your granddaughter, didn't matter whether it happens rarely or not. You want safe access to health care for her. Tommy Tuberville wants to deny that, which, by the way, as NPR points out, or PBS points out, very rare that one senator in the U.S. Senate would hold up confirmations of this high of rank over a policy by a defense secretary. Defense secretaries set policy all the time. As someone who dealt with the Department of Defense, I know this. All the time. This is one little policy in a cadre list of policies that a defense secretary sets. And because Tommy Tuberville wants to score points with the Republican mega base, he's holding out on this. This 100% pro-life agenda. Doesn't care whether the mother dies or not. And in doing so, and it combined with apparently his narcissism that Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, won't bow down to him and kiss his U.S. Senate ring, he's holding up the appointment of the commandant of the Marine Corps and 250 other flag officers. You cannot tell me, as someone who dealt with the military for almost 5 years, you cannot tell me with a straight face that doesn't have an effect on readiness. Because the person who is the COO or the chief officer, they set the agenda for everyone below them. That has an effect on readiness and preparedness, because if you don't have a permanent plan in place, that's going to affect things. There's leadership. That commandant in the Marine Corps, they also appoint their subordinates in the office. Don't tell me that, Senator Tuberville. I've actually been at the Pentagon. I've sat in private meetings at the Pentagon. I've dealt with admirals and generals in the military. I can tell you authoritatively, firsthand, what Tommy Tuberville is saying is completely untrue. And I have two beefs with this. Number one, why aren't more people calling Tommy Tuberville, why aren't more Republicans calling him out? If you really care about military defense and readiness, you should be calling Tommy Tuberville out on this. It just shows how weak Republicans really are on military preparedness these days. Number two, I'm ready for the Democrats to step up here. Chuck Schumer, Democrats, if they actually were together, they control the United States Senate. I put up a vote, change the rules in the Senate, knock this horse crap off. But see, they don't want to, it's too gentlemanly. We don't want to do something that's not, you know, up to the Senate rules.
But when you have somebody
changing the Senate rules.
When you have somebody holding up over 250 promotions within the military because they think, to share a text from somebody from Monroe earlier, women are good enough to fight for America and smart enough to fight for America, but can't control her own body. Let's ask the service women and see what they think about that. Yeah, if somebody who right. thinks that, and that's why they're stopping all of this, like, that's not acting in good faith, not at all.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. Here's somebody else saying, maybe the Marines should invite Senator Tuberville, somebody from Madison here, invite Senator Tuberville to a quote-unquote blanket party. No, I'm really not calling for him to get his butt kicked, although that seems to be what Republicans seem to link to think that is something to idolize. And is Tuberville calling for the end of aid to Israel because that government pays for abortions? That is what the Hyde Amendment says, that no federal funds could go to entities that could use funds to pay for abortions because money is fungible? Yeah, good questions. Good questions indeed. Somebody else says, I wonder how many of his players at Auburn, Tommy Tuberville's, over the years got women, quote unquote, knocked up, and those women chose to terminate those pregnancies. Did Tuberville boot those players from his teams? That'd be a great question. But to me, it gets back to the fact that Republicans want us to believe that they are the start, the middle, and the end of support to the United States military. wear the lapel flag pin, wrap themselves literally and figuratively in the flag. And yet here's an instance where they allow Republicans, one in particular, Tommy Tuberville, to hold up 250 appointments, flag officers, to the United States military. And the Democrats should change the rules and get rid of this. Because you know what? As Glenn Grothman told the Wisconsin State Senate, if Republicans or Democrats don't do it now, Republicans will. I'll guarantee you. Have some chutzpah. Back with more after this on the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show across the Civic Media Radio Network across the state of Wisconsin and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. It is Monday here on July 10th, 2023. Glad to have you along with us. Great segment coming up here. Glad you're here. As we said before at the top of the show, we talked about this article in Politico over the weekend about male masculinity. All these Republican candidates trying to out-male each other. Out testosterone each other. Sometimes you have to look at Len through life with a lens of a little humor. And that's exactly what we're going to do. Our next guest, Brian Van Hooker, joining us. He is a former staff writer at Mel. According to his own bio, specializing in pop culture, food, particularly pizza, and long-form oral histories. The great part, he's now with Cracked. He is the feature writer for Cracked magazine. Here's the cool part, Brian. Apparently you were once called a good guy by Mr. T.
Yeah, that's true. I'm quite proud. Like it was a long time ago. I was writing for Maxim magazine, making far too little on articles, and I did an interview with Mr. T, who I was thrilled to talk to. Like it's Mr. T, like right. You know, like one of the most beloved human beings. And I asked him a bunch of stupid questions, like who his favorite Muppet was, and a bunch of other dumb things. And at some point in there, he said, "You're a good guy, Brian." And that was a delight. And then they never ran the piece, which was heartbreaking.
Oh my gosh! So
I have a very crackly, rough sounding audio somewhere on my computer, but it never became anything more than just a private session with me and Mr. T. So.
But you have that memory, and I mean, not many of us would. I'd love to have a private session with Mr. T. Just sit down and chat for a while. That's pretty cool.
It was pretty cool. That was a lot of fun.
What was he like as just a person? Was he pretty chill to talk to?
Yeah, he was just super sweet. In fact, I had years ago when Conan O'Brien was still in New York City, I was an intern for the last like 9 months of Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Wow.
And Mr. T had been a guest on there, and I had mentioned this to him. I was like, "Oh, I met you once before when I was an intern on Late Night with Conan O'Brien." And he was like, "Oh my gosh, I hope I was nice to you, Brian." And I was like, "You were delightful. Like, he's just like the sweetest teddy bear of a man." So
where did you grow up and kind of how did you get into the business, as they say?
I grew up in Orange County, New York, which is about an hour north of New York City, give or take. I've been writing since I was like 14, like mostly scripts and some comic book stuff. And, then I did Late Night with Conan and befriended some of the writers there. And one of them recommended me to do some magazine writing. So I worked for Adult Swim for like, Adult Swim had like a online magazine and I worked for them for like a minute before they canceled the magazine. And, before anything of mine was published. From there, I went from Maxim to Men's Health to a handful of other places, and then spent about 5 years writing for Mel Magazine, which was like my home up until it was shut down. And then for the last year, I've been at Crack Magazine.
That's awesome.
And it's been
I've said this before this show. Writers are something that I feel are highly undervalued. I love anything that's well written. Doesn't matter whether it's an article, a book, a TV show, a movie, a song. The craft of writing to me is something sacred, and so many folks right now, Wisconsin, the Writers Guild of America on strike right now. Are you a member of the guild? And whether or not you are or not, what do you make of the strike right now?
I mean, I am not. I've not gotten a chance to do anything that would get me in there professionally. But I've talked to a number of people who are striking at the moment for various pieces at Cracked. And no, I wholeheartedly support them. They're looking out for up and coming writers and younger writers. Like some, I forget who it was, but somebody said that I spoke with that, you know, writer, whenever the writers strike like this, it's not for themselves, it's for the next generation of writers. And that's 1000% what they're doing. The, you know, that way there's no AI writing things. There's not, like, the goal was to turn writing into kind of a freelance only gig economy type of thing, but then you don't gain the experience that you need to become a good writer. Mm-hmm. Like I wrote a lot of crappy articles before I wrote any good ones. So I wholeheartedly support them, what they were doing. Cause it's,
and for those folks that might be listening or watching that don't know what we're talking about, one of the main issues of this strike is over artificial intelligence. And the whole thing is that, you know, a lot of these, the big production companies, they don't want to say it has to only be human created content. And people forget AI develops their brain, for lack of a better term, from things that real humans have already done. And it's a matter of getting residuals moving forward. And I just think this is an issue that not enough people understand. It scares the crap out of me, I'll be honest.
Yeah, same. And I frankly don't understand it as much as I should. And like a lot of people are kind of making fun of it. And I didn't think it was all that dangerous, but then you see, like, you know, it's that hard to imagine that it would start doing something like copywriting and then going further than that. That, like, you know, it's only so many steps removed. And the fact that, like, you know, Marvel's new show just had AI opening credits, like, that's like surprising for a company that would be about art and visuals. So, like, it is a very real thing there.
Well, let's give folks an example here. And one of the things I was just, you know, going through our co-executive producer, our mutual friend, Chris Pauls, sent me a couple of things for you. One of them came up on from Mel, and you were doing this oral history. And I'm a huge Seinfeld fan, you know, which when I was in college. And one of my, I just love the title, number one, A Deceptively Small Oral History of Shrinkage, the Perfect Seinfeldian Word. I mean, and so theoretically, I mean, 60 Minutes just replayed this piece by Scott Pelley over the weekend yesterday on AI. And so people don't get the technology is such now where I could tell an AI program chatbot, write me a 500-word piece on Seinfeld's history of shrinkage. And in 10 seconds, it'd be done. And it would probably be largely based on what you wrote in this article.
Yeah, that's probably true, yeah.
And so you're the one that wrote it. It's your brain that created it. But yet some chat robot gets credit for it and you don't get paid.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a very real danger. It's concerning. And like the technology is not as far away as we might think.
No. So let's actually talk about something with human credit. How about this? So these oral histories, is this something you started at Mel? Are you still doing it at Cracked, or how did this originate?
Yeah. Boy, I don't remember why I did the first one. But I started doing a lot of oral histories at Mel, which is basically me interviewing all the different parties. Like for the oral history of Shrinkage, I interviewed Peter Melman, who was a Seinfeld writer, and a few other people involved in that episode. And, basically rather than me telling the story so much, it's blurbs of dialogue of them telling the story. And I kind of shape it and put it in the order it needs to go in. I don't remember why I started it. It just sort of became a way I like to tell stories. Like I like to do interviews that really interest me. And, it was just sort of a way to, get it in a new format. So I prefer to interview people but rather than have a straight interview, I usually tend to assemble, you know, a half dozen people who were involved in a certain thing. I just did, I started at Mel, got pretty good at it. And then, Cracked had reached out to me, and eventually once Mel shut down, I could write for Cracked as well. And yeah, still doing them here. I actually published one today that was the oral history of Drunk History. And we got guys like Colin Hanks and Jesse Plemons and a whole bunch of other like really huge, awesome people who were happy to talk to us about it. Like Patton Oswalt, Michael Cera, really? Tony Hale, a whole bunch of like, and they were happy to chime in and tell the story of Drunk History, which just turned 10 yesterday. So.
I think this is great because these, to me, are subjects that real people talk about either getting drinks with friends or around the table at dinner or just hanging out. It's things that we all talk about, but you know, you put it in a way that makes it very digestible and cool to read.
Yeah, that's the hope. Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it's long. Like the one for today is it's a good 8,000 words almost. But it felt like, you know, I wanted to give it a good, thorough. Like, it's a great show, and it was literally one of the most unique shows in television history. So I wanted it to have like a clear history, but was also told you how an episode was made because it was such an interesting, unique show, and also told some bar stories of things that happened during the filming. So people throwing up on couches, falling down in horse droppings, all kinds of different things over the course of that time.
So let's go back to your time with Conan, because I was a big Conan fan, still am. I thought he got a raw deal from NBC and loved his work at Late Night. How old were you when you started interning on Late Night? I guess the first knee jerk reaction, kind of just overall, what was the experience like?
Well, everybody was really cool. I was an intern. I was 30. No, I was 20. Oh hell, 22-ish, okay, maybe, sure. Maybe a little more than that. I can't remember.
Mid 20s. So,
But yeah, no, it was cool. It was great. I mean, everybody there. I mean, Conan has a reputation for being somebody who doesn't like, who's a kind person who doesn't like treat other people poorly and doesn't indulge people who are treating others poorly. And so like everybody who's there was super kind and giving. And I made a number of friends there. Joel Goddard, the announcer for Late Night. I'm like, genuinely one of my dearest friends still. I talk to him every week. A number of the writers there were super kind, and some set me up with little jobs. And I'm actually on a monthly basis, I've been doing oral histories of Late Night sketches. So like there's a variety of different sketches on there, like Preparation H. Raymond and a certain self-pleasing bear.
Yes,
and a few others.
Exactly.
That are
exactly. I was hoping that we have, I think we could say that, right? Can't we say masturbating bear on the radio? If not, I'm not sure, but I think you can. That's a human act, right?
Yeah.
So that was a great sketch on Late Night.
I think as long as you don't go into any detail about it,
we're
you
not going
into
any detail. But explain what this this sketch was, and we can use self gratifying. But I thought it was one of the best sketches on Conan, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was just this bear wearing a diaper that would occasionally like interrupt a sketch and pleasure himself.
Exactly.
And it was probably Conan's Conan had a lot of goofy characters, but that was probably the single most iconic one. And so that I reached out to the writer the writer who was in the bear costume, who a lot of people wrote the masturbating bear sketches. But he and I had him tell the story of what it was like being in that costume and where the bear is now and things he got from fans who love the bear and all the other crazy things. Been doing those for about like 8 months now, different, like one little story about his sketch and where it was born and how it evolved and all that stuff.
See, my friends know me though. I'm somebody in media who loves media. Like I love little unique stories like that, kind of the behind the scenes things that we don't, you know, people viewing the show, you don't know that. And it's fascinating to me to know what people are doing behind the scenes.
Yeah, me too. I love to know where ideas come from and how they change and reactions people get. And I love that stuff. So that's why I dig into it.
What was your biggest takeaway? What are the thing that you, I guess, learned or the thing you took away from that experience working on Late Night with Conan O'Brien?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know. I know that there was a lot of kind people, and I think it was just, I think one thing I really gained was that's the kind of environment that I wanted to work in, is that it's not people one-upping each other. It was really collaborative. People were really cool. There weren't egos. Like, I took a picture with Conan. I said hello to him a few times. Like, but he was like kind and giving and like a respectful, nice dude. And same for everybody who was there. Like, they're just good people. So I think like how basically from the top people set a tone of respectfulness. And I think that goes in any work environment, frankly.
And that's so heartening for me to hear, because to your point, it doesn't matter whether it's in media or broadcast or any other job. If you have an environment that's just a jerk environment, you don't like to be there. I mean, that sucks for your work environment, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a given.
You want to be people you enjoy being with. When we come back, I want to know Brian's take on pizza in New York, but also have you done like pizza like reviews of other places?
I've done a few. Yeah, I've done more like investigative history of pizzas, things like that. But I have done some reviews and some gonzo stuff. One of my favorite pieces ever was 840 pizzas in 30 days.
Good
spike,
gosh.
Papa John.
40 so a lot pizzas of- in 30 days. All right. We'll ask Brian about that a little bit and see. Maybe we can get him here to Wisconsin. Have a little Salvador's tomato pies or Ian's or something like that. Stay with us now. It is Brian Van Hooker. He is with Cracked Magazine, the feature writer. This is the Todd Allbowles Show, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Pizza time.
Pursuing truth wherever it may lead and having fun doing so. Welcome back to the Todd Allbowles Show across the Civic Media Radio Network across Wisconsin and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. Having fun with Brian Van Hooker. That's the name of this segment. And Mr. Zommer's there alluded to it. It's pizza time. He is the feature writer for Cracked Magazine, formerly of Mel. And as we found out today, also formerly of The Late Show with Conan O'Brien. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it today. So tell us more about this specializing in pizza food, but particularly pizza. So you've done reviews, you've written reviews. Are they actually serious or are they comedy or a combination?
I mean, it's been a few different things. I've kind of had a lifelong obsession with the Ninja Turtles and pizza, kind of gone hand in hand with that. So I've done a number of like stories, like histories about pizza, also weird stories about it. There was this story a few years ago where Papa John, whatever that guy's name is, John.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The guy that
guy.
Yeah,
it said he ate 40 pizzas in 30 days, and then like 3 days later, he reneged on it and said, "Well, I didn't actually eat 40 pizzas." And then like I kind of jokingly said, "Like I almost eat that amount of pizza anyway," in a pitch meeting. And then from that, it turned into I'm going to actually do this out of pure spite to Papa John, and proceeded for the next 30 days to eat 40 whole pizzas, not personal pizzas. I set a rule of it had to be a small pizza or larger.
Gosh.
Because to me, a personal pizza would be cheating. That's not
right,
good.
Right.
So it was small pizza or larger over the next 30 days of my life.
And you did it.
I did it. Yeah. No, I absolutely good. I did it.
Were these like average size 12, 14 inches, 16 inches?
I mean, it depended. So like I didn't want to do just one pizza. And I also, Papa John itself is not my favorite kind of pizza, so right, I only had that once. it was everything from like I would make a breakfast pizza in the morning, and it was a small pizza, to like I would eat as much of a large pizza at night and then have some of it the next day and all that. But it was all told at the end of the whole 30 days, it was 40 pizzas on the dot.
That is fantastically impressive.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of myself. I mean, I'm proud of myself for many stupid feats. That's one of them.
Gastrointestinally, not going into too much detail, but I mean, your body withstood that okay?
Yeah, I'm ashamed to admit this. It wasn't that shocking of a change from status quo. So my body was like, oh are you doing anything differently?
No big deal. Big deal. All right, do you have a favorite out there in New York? Do you have a favorite one or your top two or three pizzas that you consider just if you come to New York, you got to try this?
Oh, I mean, I have a single favorite pizza place, like it's the best pizza on the planet kind of place.
All right.
I used to live in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and literally I think the best pizza on planet Earth is Bay Ridge Pizza, their grandma pie in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
All right. I'm writing this down.
Amazing. Like I will drive, I live about an hour and a half, 2 hours from the city, from there now, from where I used to live.
Yeah.
But if I'm ever in the city limits and I'm like, oh, well, it's only 45 minutes to go get a pizza. Which is 90 minutes total to waste to just drive there, but it's entirely worth it. So that's my favorite. But I also like I think fast food pizza is fine. Like I think I like Domino's, frankly. Like
really?
I don't think it's great. I don't think it's as good. But it's the difference between a Big Mac and an actual good burger. Like they're both enjoyable. They're just different animals. So
I'm a thin crust kind of guy. I like a thin crust, and out in New York, you have to like fold it, right, and then eat it that way.
Yeah, you have to fold it. Like, yeah, it's a hand. Like, yeah, there's the whole.
You know when the out of towners are in it, you just look at them. You're like, they're not from here.
Yeah, they're eating it with a fork or something. Yeah.
No, you don't want to eat pizza with a fork. My God.
One of my favorite pieces I did was pizza oriented. Was I did So I did this one piece where I was back a few years ago. Marvel had done this 60-hour Marvel marathon, where it was 60 hours straight of Marvel movies at an AMC theater, like no sleeping, no whatever.
Right.
And then good I spent God. Like the next day and a half in a hangover recovering from that. And at one point I woke up to go pee, and I had this idea of like, I wonder if the Domino's pizza tracker is real. So I did this piece that turned like super viral and all this stuff, where I was going to debunk the Domino's pizza tracker. So I like ordered, I went to Domino's, my local Domino's, ordered from it in the store, and saw if like the steps they were doing were the actual steps right. that were being clicked off in the Domino's pizza tracker. They weren't.
Really?
And like literally as my delivery guy left, I like got in my car and followed him. And like ran through a red light to make sure I stayed with him. So like it was like there's some automated parts, some parts that are like you push a button and say the step is done.
Right.
But like it was more like, oh, we gotta, it wasn't there, like there's not as connected to the pizza tracker to reality as I would have liked. So but I was quite proud of that whole thing because it turned into this crazy thing.
See, that's the kind of piece I'm talking about, because I mean, too often we get, you know, did Trump have the confidential papers at Mar-a-Lago? And I understand that's important journalism, but I mean, really, the average gal or guy, I mean, they want to know whether the Domino's tracker is real. Those are things that real people talk about.
Yeah,
and that's fantastic. We got somebody writing about it.
Yeah, no, I was pretty proud of that, and I also did a piece about whether pineapple on pizza is legitimate or not.
Yes or no?
Like, so I like pineapple on pizza.
See, so do I.
So do I.
No, but,
yes.
But I was like, well, it shouldn't be up to just me. So I got a panel of experts. I got three Italian chefs, three food historians, three food critics, three food scientists, and three Ninja Turtles voice actors to weigh in and decide whether it's legitimate or illegitimate. The food scientists were cool with it.
Mm.
The Italian chefs were not cool with it. The food critics were not cool with it. The food historians were fine with it because food comes from everywhere.
Right.
But to my surprise, so it was tied. And then one Ninja Turtle guy, one Michelangelo actor said, yes, he's fine with it. Another Michelangelo actor said, no, he's not fine with it. And I literally, my last call was to a guy who played Donatello and Raphael. His name is Rob Alston. He's a great voice actor. He also played Pinky the Brain and Yakko and all this other great stuff. And anyway, so he said he is not a fan of pineapple on pizza, and thus I scientifically disproved pineapple on pizza, despite the fact that I personally love it.
See, again, that's and you went to legitimate research. I mean, you didn't just grab somebody off the street.
This is far too much effort. Yeah, some of my favorite stuff to do is put an obscene amount of effort into something that's not worth it. Like I was trying to find out what a Roadrunner would have tasted like, and that was a lot of research, like an obscene amount of research.
Come out to Wisconsin, we can just feed you a little Sandhill cream, very similar to Roadrunner. Okay. I think.
But if you're putting it on pizza, then I'll eat it. Sure.
Absolutely. Brian Van Hooker, he is with the wonderful publication called Cracked.com. He is the feature writer there. Brian, thanks so much for hanging out with us on a Monday after. We appreciate it. We'd love to have you back soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you so much. Brian Van Hooker, feature writer for Cracked.com. You can find his work there. Check him out. Yeah, talented guy, great writer. Check out Matt Flynn as well with Matt Flynn Direct for the top of news at 3 o'clock. Thanks for being with us, everybody. Thanks to Mr. Zomers, our producer and engineer. And thank you for listening. Remember, whatever you're fighting for, whatever you believe in, keep banging your drum.